Well, good morning. I'm calling to order this joint meeting of the House Early Childhood Housing and Preventing Homelessness Committees, calling to order the meeting wish to provide greetings to members of the public joining us and the members as well. This hearing is being held pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. Members of the public, you'll want to visit our committee websites to see the meeting materials. We've got an agenda and other materials that you can find right there. We're gonna delay just a bit on the calling of the roll. And I just wanna note how excited I am to be joining with Chair Houseman and Chair Gomez and with all of you to examine this, this issue of housing instability and the impact on young kids. This is something that I've had an interest in for a long time and worked with a group called Elders for Infants. And there's a member of that group, Mary Kay Stronach, who's been a particular champion on this issue, because I want to give her a little bit of a shout out for her to be pushing this. As I think we're going to learn over the course of the next little while, kids who experience housing instability when they're young end up having that impact their lives in all kinds of ways that end up impacting the rest of us. And so I'm just really happy to be here. I'm not sure if Chair Houseman has anything that that she would like to add.
Yes.
Please.
Thank you to all the committee for being here and Representative Pinto for your leadership on this issue. Ever since I first started on this issue of housing, one of the lines I frequently used in my speeches was to cite University of Minnesota research that by the time a child reaches fifth grade, if they've been homeless or highly mobile, they're achieving at the level of a second grader who's been in stable housing. That was a contributing factor, housing stability and a child's ability to learn. This morning's newspaper also, the Star Tribune, also has a commentary on food insecurity and its impact also on the youngest child. And so here's the thing, we've had that research for a long time. We haven't been doing enough. And so your work, Representative Pinto, starts us down the road of being more aggressive. We know what the research says, and we should do something about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I know we have Chair Gomez as well. And so please, Madam Chair, anything that you want to say to kick things off?
Sure. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for putting this together and bringing us together to talk about this really critical issue. I wanted to share a story like briefly. So we're getting ready for this hearing, and I was on the phone with my CA, and we were talking about, you know, we had this really great researcher in our committee who talked about the impact of not acting on homelessness for sort of older kids and what the cost to society is for that. And we were talking about, could we find somebody who could make a similar case? And, so we're kind of going back and forth, and I had a friend over, and I got off the phone, and he was like, wait, you're looking for a researcher to show that it's bad for babies to be homeless? Like, what is wrong with what you do? And I was like, you know, so it was an important, moment for me to be like, oh yeah, that's kind of like absurd that we have to make this case that we all know, right? Like, we all know this intuitively, right? That when people are not cared for early in life, that it has these cascading impacts on their lives. And if we don't act to address, you know, this instability in their lives, that we as a society will be paying for it potentially for generations. Because what we're seeing is that this problem of homelessness has become an intergenerational issue. When you experience homelessness as a child, you are many, many times more likely, it's something like 20 times more likely, I can't remember, Wilder knows, to experience an episode of homelessness when you're an adult or when you're a young adult. So Chair Pinto knows this, and Chair Houseman has been in the position to oversee this program, but Homework Starts with Home is just such an incredible program. It's really like, I just really think it's such a good model for how to like support families that need a hand, where it's like we're seeing more and more folks who are really impacted by the increased cost of housing and stagnating wages, and so more and more people who are experiencing homelessness are working, it becomes even more difficult, of course, when you have a family, when you have a baby, when you add childcare costs onto the top of that. So, you know, I think this model of homework starts with home, where it's like, you know, some rental assistance and some really intensive supportive case management and kind of like a collaboration between the institutions that a family interacts with is really, really a hopeful model. And I'm just really thankful for Chair Pinto bringing this forward and for the governor including it in his budget, and looking forward to this hearing. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I'm really excited to get going. So let's do that by having Mr. Doslin, the Early Childhood Committee Legislative Assistant, take the role.
Good morning, everyone. Please bear with me. I believe I have everyone on here. So we'll start with Representative Gomez, Chair.
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hausman, Chair.
Present.
Present. Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Howard, Vice Chair.
Howard, present.
Representative Keeler, Vice Chair. Representative Keeler, Vice Chair. Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Pryor, present.
Representative Franzen, lead.
Present.
Representative New Brindley, lead.
Present.
Representative Tice is excused. Representative Agbaje.
Present.
Representative Bennett is excused. Representative Bliss. Representative Bliss.
This is Representative Juergens. Representative Bliss, I believe, has something in his district today.
All right, thank you. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, present.
Representative Daniels is excused. Representative Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney, present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Hassan.
Hassan is present.
Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, thank you. Representative Herr is excused. Representative Hollins.
Hollins, present.
Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein, present.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, present.
Representative Cagle.
Cagle, present.
Representative Cotizo Batum.
Present.
Representative Morrison is excused. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Petersburg. Representative Petersburg. Representative Farr.
Farr, present.
Representative Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Representative Wozniak.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
I would say we have quite a quorum, in fact. So thank you, members. So our first item of business is to hear a presentation on the impact of stable housing on child development. As Chair Gomez said, there's some aspects of that should be really clear to all of us. And then also learning more details can be helpful too. So we have Dr. Jeanette Herbers with Villanova University. And so Dr. Herbers, if you can identify yourself further, and then please proceed with your presentation. We're so glad to have you with us. And I should say, to be able to do that, that's one benefit of virtual hearings. We're able to have some national expertise join us relatively easily. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. It's a privilege to be here. My name is Jeanette Herbers. I'm an associate professor of psychological and brain sciences at Villanova University. I want to say quickly, this presentation was put together with support from two of my close colleagues, Dr. Ann Mastin from the University of Minnesota and Dr. J.J. Catulli from Nemours Children's Health System. And J.J. Catulli and I did our doctoral work with Dr. Mastin at Minnesota. And we did a lot of research on this topic with her and there at that time. So it's really a privilege to be able to give something back today, I hope. So I will share my slides. We seeing just the presentation?
Yep, I am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so my goal in this presentation today is to convey the best information we know from the scholarship on risk and resilience in children who experience homelessness with their families. And starting from this premise that we understand that children don't develop independently and spontaneously on their own, but that they develop within these other systems. They develop within their families, and their families live within neighborhoods and communities. And neighborhoods and communities are located within these broader social and political contexts that impact their functioning. So we can appreciate how all of these different systems work together and interact with each other to influence the child's development from the very beginning, from the time they're in their mother's wombs. So in the study of risk and resilience, we really seek to identify and understand what we call risk factors, which are all kinds of factors across these different systems that are associated with problems for children in their development. And then we also seek to identify and understand what we call protective factors, which are also factors across all of these different systems that can act to support healthy child development and in many cases to counteract, prevent, or mitigate some of these risks. So the goal in this endeavor is to ultimately to inform interventions with the goals of preventing or reducing these risk factors in the lives of children, and at the same time, seeking to support and bolster these protective factors to enable all children to develop healthy and have successful, productive, and meaningful, happy lives. So within the science, with a focus on early childhood in particular, early childhood meaning ages 5 and under, this is a quick summary of our best understanding of these risk and resilience situations. So if you look at the blue column on the right, this describes what we understand to be indicators of resilience. So if children early childhood are doing well, then we expect that they have positive, secure relationships with their families, that they're meeting their growth milestones in terms of their physical development, their language, their learning, and that they're engaging with their worlds and exploring and playing and doing all of the things that we like to see little children do. You can also see in the red column here, this is a short summary of the most important threats. Some of them are also sometimes called ACEs or adverse childhood experiences. So these are the things we recognize to be especially harmful in early childhood. And then in the center, in the green, are these protective factors. Again, this is a short summary. You can go into a great deal of detail, but these are really key ones, and they're highly relevant to the discussion today. So what you can see in those red and green columns, if you kind of scan, is that there's a big emphasis on the functioning of the caregiver, parents or other primary caregivers, who are those family contexts for young children, because when caregivers and families are struggling, then they're going to have more difficulty providing for their children in numerous ways. And also this emphasis on stability in environments and avoiding lack of resources whenever possible, providing resources, and maintaining some stability and consistency to avoid these chaotic environments of upheaval and unpredictability. Specifically for children in families who experience homelessness, the first thing that we have to understand is that these are families in extreme poverty. And so all of the many risks that we know are associated with extreme poverty occur in the lives of these children. These are chronic risks like unemployment or underemployment, food insecurity, as was mentioned previously. People who live in poverty have higher rates of stressful and traumatic experiences, They have high disproportionate rates of mental illness and other disability. And these are chronic ongoing challenges in these lives of these children at these different systems levels that you can see in this diagram here. When a family has unstable housing, then they experience a host of new acute risks related to that episode of homelessness. And these pile on top of these chronic risks that families are already struggling with. So they include not only loss of housing, but also often loss of possessions, sometimes separations from family members, sometimes sometimes this occurs in the context of traumatic experiences like family violence and other serious relationship conflicts. The episode of homelessness can bring more stress and trauma. And when children and their families lose housing, they move. So they may move to a shelter or other temporary situation like a hotel or sometimes even a campground or a vehicle. Or they may move in with family and friends for financial necessity, what we call doubled up homelessness. These spaces tend to be crowded. And importantly, they're disconnected from the systems that the family was previously involved with and the space-based and place-based resources the family had been using and relying on. Furthermore, when they move, they're often moving to a situation that they expect to be temporary. So then whether they're going to re-engage or how to re-engage and establish new community and social supports remains an ongoing challenge. I hope to convey in the next portion here the following, which is to help paint this picture of why stable housing is so essential, and also how residential instability invokes all these different risks. And finally, to support this point that mobility and homelessness disconnects families from these ordinary connections and supports that those of us with stable living take for granted. Quickly, I just want to present a bit of information on scope. I know that in the next presentation, there will be more information, so I'm keeping this brief. These are national data that give estimates of the number of students who experience homelessness in the United States and also young children under the age of 6 who experience homelessness. When we say homelessness, that's defined as lacking a fixed, regular, and adequate accommodation. And as I mentioned, that can include staying in shelter. A lot of what we know is based on people who stay in shelter, but families also stay in other forms of temporary or substandard housing. And the majority live doubled up. So they're not, they can't afford their own housing, so they stay with family or friends. So these estimates are the best we have, but probably still underestimate the problem to some degree, especially for young children who aren't often connected to services like schools that keep track. Here is another way of looking at family homelessness for young children. These are data from the most recent HUD reports. And what you can see here are the proportions of sheltered families with children compared to US families and children living in poverty compared to all US families with children. So if you look at the two leftmost columns, you can see that children in general, there are high rates in these populations of children in general, and also that the very youngest children are starkly overrepresented in families staying in shelter. So about half of children under 18 in shelter are actually children 5 and under, the very youngest early childhood age.
Dr. Herbers, could I just clarify something? So that phrase sheltered families, when I saw that, I thought that meant families who have stable housing, but sheltered families means families staying in shelters for those experiencing unstable housing. Is that right? Can you just clarify that phrase?
Yes, thank you for the question. My apologies. Yes, sheltered means staying in a shelter, like in an emergency or transitional or other temporary shelter accommodation.
Thanks for the clarification.
Yes, thank you. So What we know about this experience is, again, as was mentioned, probably not shocking, but we have research to support what we suspect, which is that being homeless as a young person is harmful to development. And we can see impacts across all of the key domains of development, including physical health, mental and emotional health, learning, and academics. So next, I'm just going to briefly highlight some recent research that shows these impacts. This is some work that my colleagues and I did with a large representative sample of low-income urban families in the United States. And we looked at nearly 4,000 children. For this work, we were especially interested in trying to isolate the impact of homelessness beyond these many associated risks. So within this sample, we identified the children as either literally homeless, meaning staying in shelters or those other temporary accommodations, versus staying doubled up. And we looked at those experiences starting from birth through the age of 9. And we compared these children who had experienced homelessness in childhood to a carefully matched group of children. We used these characteristics here to match so that we knew we were comparing these children who had experienced homelessness to children who had never been homeless but experienced many of the associated risks here. And what we did is we looked at these homelessness experiences in childhood to predict how well these same individuals were doing with their mental health in adolescence. What we found is that we looked at profiles of mental health in 15-year-old youth, we found that those who had experienced homelessness as children were less likely to be doing well across the board in their mental health, what we call competence, and were substantially more likely to show these profiles of mental health problems, including things like anxiety, depression, and aggression and rule-breaking type behaviors. In terms of academic achievement, some of the work that we did with the Minneapolis Public School District data, we were able to look at achievement scores in the same students across several grades and look at growth in both reading and math achievement. This graph is the reading scores. And again, what you can see here is that we compared the children who had experienced homelessness, either sheltered or doubled up, or high residential mobility. And that's the bottom curve there. We compared their academics to children who were receiving free meals or reduced price meals, and finally to the children who were not receiving any financial assistance. And you can see very stark achievement gaps here that start early and persist. In addition to this, so this starts at third grade and shows these gaps through eighth grade. We also were able to look in this with this district data at first grade scores, so to try and catch achievement very early. And we found the same kinds of disparities when we compared homeless and highly mobile first graders on their performance on a first grade oral reading assessment. So these numbers actually represent words read per minute in first grade. And you can see that the HHM students were reading about 40 words per minute on average in first grade, compared to across the whole district, almost 60 words per minute. And then the general group who were not receiving free meals or reduced price meals and had not experienced homelessness were reading at more than double the rate of the homeless and highly mobile students in first grade. So we can see that these achievement gaps appear very early, as early as first grade. And some of the work that Ann Mastin and her colleagues have been doing most recently suggests that these gaps, we can predict these gaps based on even earlier indicators at preschool screening assessments or with assessments of children's executive functioning, meaning their ability to control their behaviors and manage their thinking in planful ways that relate to later achievement. Again, all this underscores that the early childhood period is vulnerable as well, and that these things we see in school-aged children probably have started much earlier and could be addressed much earlier than school. In some of our other work, we've looked specifically at infants and toddlers in family shelters to assess where they're, how they're doing with their developmental milestones. So we use a screener for development called the Brigance screener. And here we're just showing rates of those who scored substantially below average on this developmental screener among a sample of infants. It says toddler, that's 1 year old. So infants under 1 year olds and 2 year olds. And you can see here again that a substantial proportion, especially for those toddler age kids, are scoring below average when we look at these shelter samples. This makes sense with everything we know about brain development early in childhood, because so much important growth and learning occurs in the very earliest months and years of life. This diagram is just a visual that represents brain development. Those are brain cells, and you can see just how much growth there is from the brain cells of the newborn compared to 3 months and 2 years old. This brain development happens rapidly, and it also happens in concert with development of physical immune functioning and stress regulation, which relates to all of these key milestones we're concerned about. To quickly recap, this is what I showed you at the beginning. This is sort of thinking about resilience in all early childhood. And I'm just going to quickly highlight the things that we've talked about in the context of homelessness. So children who experience homelessness are much more likely to experience all of these threats and adverse childhood experiences based on their chronic risks of poverty and acute risks of homelessness. And also that I've demonstrated with some data early, in very early childhood, we see evidence of some problems at these key indicators of resilience. And we suspect, you know, based on what we know, that some of these other aspects of functioning are part of the story as well, based on what we know about housing and unstable housing and those more qualitative experiences. So finally, our goal here is to do whatever we can to stop and prevent the threats and adversities, prevent homelessness when possible, and also prevent things associated that may precipitate homelessness or may accompany homelessness. And then, of course, to bolster these key assets and protections at the same time to give every child the best opportunity to do well. So the intervention data for families with children who are already homeless, we have some strong evidence from the Family Options Study, which was a randomized controlled trial done by HUD across 20 US cities. And they compared different housing interventions looking at key outcomes for families. And what they found rather clearly was that the long-term subsidies for housing by far were the most effective in improving family functioning. We can then see in the prevention literature that these housing subsidies seem to really be key, that first and foremost, these families need that stability in place, and they need some amount of a reliable source of resource before they can address maybe some of the other challenges. And also that case management and opportunities to help families connect and stay connected with services can enhance the effectiveness of those subsidies as well. In summary, my goal was to convince you all that early childhood homelessness is prevalent, that it presents a clear and a potent threat to healthy child development, and that it can be prevented, and that we have some good clues about the most effective ways to do that for families, which are not necessarily the same as the most effective ways to do that for single adults. Mainly that these housing subsidies and these connections to key resources and supports are the biggest factors involved. So I'll conclude there. Thank you all very much.
Dr. Herbers, thank you so much. That was really done in a really helpful and concise and focused way, and really powerful too. So thank you. Members, I think our plan is, if there's any quick clarifying questions that folks have, we can maybe do that. But otherwise, I think the hope is to work through a number of other presentations. And Dr. Herbers, if you're able to stick around, but then the plan would be to have questions across the series of presentations. So I'm not seeing any hands up for those quick clarifying questions. So what I'm going to do in that case is to hand things off to Chair Hausman for the next portion of the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, we're going to formally move House File 3210 a little bit later in the meeting to be before the committee for a vote by the Early Childhood Committee members. But for now, we'll have Representative Pinto speak to 3210 by way of introduction to four testifiers who are here with us today. So Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, we'll hear greater detail from the testifiers about the bill. Chair Gomez had referenced the Homework Starts at Home program. And what this bill does is takes that program, which currently starts with children who are in pre-K up to grade 12, and provides support for their families for housing. And in recognition of the research Dr. Herbers just said, it extends the program down to birth up. I guess I just want to emphasize in the lead into the testifiers presenting just how important it is. I feel like we so often, members of the Early Childhood Committee be familiar with this, we so often think of programs and systems from a school-based or K-12 perspective. And we've talked a lot in our committee about the need to be thinking younger as well. But I think what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is simply to move to those testifiers. I will note there is an amendment, members, that will formally take up at the end that simply make sure that the program can continue to serve those children who are adults and in perhaps a grade 12, they've turned 18, their families can still receive support. That's true under the current program. We just want to make sure it would be true after this bill as well. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. And first we have Aaron Bailey, who's Assistant Commissioner and Executive Director, Children's Cabinet. Ms. Bailey, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, chairs and members of the three committees. My name is Aaron Bailey, and I am an Assistant Commissioner in Minnesota Management and Budget and the Executive Director of the Governor's Children's Cabinet. As a leader in state agency, cross-agency work, I'm really very excited to be here to speak about this incredible opportunity to talk about how we've come together, including with information from many of you, to prioritize young children and their families and make smart investments that positively impact and improve their lives and the lives of their parents and families as well. The Children's Cabinet is housed within MMB, and it's an interagency partnership. The governor has charged with leveraging cross-agency coordination and leadership to help make Minnesota the best place for each and every child to grow up. And per our role in this joint committee, you'll hear from multiple state agency partners and with each of the three committees to focus on the important issue of housing stability for young children and their families. As you heard earlier, we hear frequently from advocates and families. And like I said, many of you have been key partners in hearing the information and prioritization as well, that stable housing is an essential component and building block of the early years. Housing stability impacts all aspects of a child's development, including their health, their access to supports that help them thrive, and their opportunity to learn and grow during their important early years. In cross-agency conversations convened through the Children's Cabinet, the need for more resources and connections to housing supports in early childhood has been lifted up by state leaders and is a priority for the governor, and thus that is the proposal that you hear about today. I want to thank Dr. Herbers for her testimony today. The research that she highlighted is something that we too have closely followed. The data and stories you're hearing is why the Children's Cabinet supported these cross-agency conversations to help develop and expand what is a successful Homework Starts with Home program and what was included in the governor's supplemental budget that we'll present on this morning. We know our state programs and local service providers are identifying young children experiencing homelessness right now. You'll hear more about the data later in the presentation. And the goal of this proposal is that when a young child is identified as experiencing housing instability, we'll have additional community connections and resources to address the need impacting the whole family and the whole child in their youngest years and beyond. We'll have the resources to wrap around and support those needs that we can already identify. Just as your three committees are meeting together today, we're bringing an interagency perspective to solving housing stability challenges for children and their families. Today's state presentation includes representatives from two interagency bodies working together on these proposals, the Children's Cabinet and the Interagency Council on Homelessness, as well as leaders from the Minnesota Department of Education and from Minnesota Housing. With that, chairs, unless there are questions for me, I am going to turn it over to my esteemed colleague, Eric Grumdahl.
We will, I think we'll hold questions until all four have spoken. So next we have Eric Grumdahl, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. Mr. Grumdahl, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you, Aaron. My name is Eric Grumdahl, and I serve as the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. And so over the next 25 minutes or so, what we really hope to do is share with you our distillation of what we know about the scale of the unmet needs in Minnesota for children and families that are facing housing instability, a bit about the resources that we have at play right now to respond to those challenges, and really how that then motivates the proposal in front of you for even greater coordination and an expansion of the eligibility for Homework Starts with Home. And so diving right in, to get to the scale of need. One of the things to highlight right away in this space is that there are actually multiple data points. And so we're really trying to use every angle, every lens that we can to be able to depict the challenges that families and children are facing and view the data as being a really critical way to lift up stories and voices and experiences that are otherwise too often invisible. The data you're looking at on this screen is based on counts that are conducted by schools, public and charter schools all across Minnesota. And those use the definition that of homelessness that you heard Dr. Herbers refer to, that these are students that lack a fixed, regular, and adequate place to stay. And so these are also pre-pandemic figures. And so important to note that. But I think what this picture really shows incredibly well is the breadth of these housing stability challenges all across the state. So 77 of Minnesota's 87 counties have identified students experiencing homelessness in that October 1, 2019 data. I think the other piece to note is that over the course of the year, as schools continue to identify students that may not be recognized as homeless or may not be experiencing homelessness on October 1st of each year, we see that over the course of each school year, that number roughly doubles in terms of how many students each school year get identified. We also see really important disproportionalities and disparities in terms of who experiences homelessness in Minnesota, both for the student population, as we see for the adults as well. And so some of those disparities are for students of color, American Indian students, LGBTQ students, and students with disabilities. We've also noted that over the last 2 years, so October 1 of 2020 and October 1 of 2021, the pandemic counts, pandemic era counts have been lower for these students. We are unsure to what extent that is a factor of the difficulty of identifying and engaging students successfully during the pandemic, or a mirror of some of the trends that we are seeing in terms of reductions in family homelessness. So we'll be continuing to monitor those trends and again, corroborating with other data sources. I want to just dive in then to that disparity information, specifically looking at disparities in terms of race and ethnicity. This chart shows you the comparison between homeless students in the green bar. These are pre-K through 12 students identified as homeless by schools, compared to the entire student body for that same age range. And what we see is that African-American and American Indian students in particular are vastly overrepresented among the homeless student body. And that, again, mirrors some of the disparities we also see for adults. You heard Dr. Herbers, I think, give just an amazing and a powerful summary of all of the research that we know about the impacts and the risks that are facing students that are confronting housing instability. And so I won't go at great depth here, but I'll just lift up a couple of pieces of Minnesota information that I think would be helpful in kind of triangulating with what you heard from Dr. Herbers. And so this is a picture, the graph on the right side of the slide is a picture of the math proficiency at the third grade test. These are three groups of students, the entire student body, students that are receiving free or reduced lunch, but who are not homeless, and finally the homeless students identified by schools. The bottom two segments of each stacked bar means that those students are meeting proficiency. And so what you see is that homeless students are achieving proficiency on those third grade reading math standards at a rate that is less than half the general student body, and even lower than other students who are also low income, but not facing a housing crisis. And so I think it again anchors some of the points that you heard from Dr. Herbers about the significant impact. We see very similar impacts in terms of reading scores as well. And we also look at this over the course of a student's entire academic career. One of the things that is, I think, most devastating in that data is that right now, the most recent information we have about graduation rates is that within the class of 2020, less than half of students flagged as homeless graduated on time. That compares to a statewide graduation average of 84% for all students. And when we look at the intersectionalities, again, in that data set, we also see that those same racial and ethnic disparities also translate into lower graduation rates for American Indian students in particular who are experiencing homelessness. Only 35% of that group in the class of 2020 graduated on schedule. One other piece as we then kind of think about not just the students that are facing housing instability across pre-K through 12, but in early childhood as well, is that we understand that about equal proportions of students are in that kind of early childhood range and in the K through 12 age range. And so one of the ways to think about this information is that even though we may have less crisp or precise information about early childhood, given that we don't have the comparable kind of school age count, we do suspect, based on the data sources that we have, that it's roughly the same scale in terms of measured in the tens of thousands. One of the best sources of information we have is the source that Dr. Herbers referenced for the national data set, looking at the number of kids under age six who are facing housing instability. That's an analysis conducted by the Department of Education at the federal level. And in the most recent yearbook for the state profiles released just last year, during the 2018-2019 school year, the Department of Education estimated that there were almost 16,000 kids age five and younger who are facing some form of homelessness during that single year. That translates into 1 in 27 children. And so again, to get a sense of scale, this is in the tens of thousands of kids is kind of our best data to estimate that. We also know that while we have a variety of places to intersect and engage students who are facing housing crises, most of the resources that really are able to target those housing crises are also incredibly oversubscribed, and so very difficult to make those connections to a live, viable housing resource. Here's another set of information, just again to get a hands on the scale of the problem. We looked at public assistance records that are deployed through county governments and recorded up through the MACSIS system to the State Department of Human Services. And over a couple of data points, we estimate that at any point in time, there are between 300 and 400 infants, children age one or younger, who are experiencing homelessness at any point in time. In addition, we looked at our state's homeless management information system and identified around 500 kids that are born into homelessness each year. So they're born while their families are in a shelter or a transitional housing program or otherwise experiencing a homeless situation. We also see the same racial and ethnic disparities in that data as well. So next, to talk about just some of the places where families are getting engaged and receiving support, I'm going to turn this over to Nikki Kovan. Nikki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. And next we have Nikki Kovan, Early Learning Division Director in the Minnesota Department of Education. Ms. Kovan, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'm really excited to be here today. Nikki Kulvan, the Director of the Early Learning Services Division at the Minnesota Department of Education. So yeah, I'm happy to be here talking about this proposal because early childhood providers are really on the front line of serving these vulnerable young children and their families that we've been talking about today. And the complex needs of these children and their families can be overwhelming. And so this work is so important for both providers and the families they serve. The science is clear that serving whole families and providing wraparound supports and services that are comprehensive in nature is really critical to producing the kind of long-term outcomes and benefits that early childhood services can provide. As these data show on the slide, young children experiencing homelessness are being served by many of our early learning programs in addition to other early childhood services. In early learning programs, children experiencing homelessness are categorically eligible and or prioritized for these services. Just over one quarter of early learning scholarships are awarded to a child who has or is currently experiencing homelessness, and about 1 in 12 children accessing Head Start are reported to be experiencing homelessness as well. These programs are often the first support systems for families that identify a family's housing instability. In that way, they can be critical points of connection and referral for families that they serve. Unfortunately, with how much demand exists for programs to address housing issues, as Eric had mentioned earlier, there's often not a resource available that can partner with these early childhood programs to address the underlying housing issues. So that's a gap that we see in early learning services and an opportunity to help support families by creating connections between early childhood and housing programs. Partnerships where each partner can bring their own expertise to meet the needs of the whole family are therefore so important. So that's really what I was here to support this proposal. And with that, I'll hand it back to Eric. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kulvan. Finally, we have Dan Kitzberger, who is the Legislative Director of Minnesota Housing. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kitzberger. Please identify yourself for the record.
My apologies, Chair Hausman. This is Eric Rumdahl again. We made things a little complicated for the chair, and I apologize for that. I'm going to pick back up where Nikki left off, and then I'll hand it off to Dan in just a moment.
So my apologies. Right. Sorry about that, Mr. Rumdahl.
Thank you. We just wanted to name and note some of the other really important targeted homeless interventions that exist. And so that includes the supports that schools provide directly to homeless students when they're identified on that lacking a fixed, regular, and adequate place to live. The resources that are really designed to help students stay connected to their school and have the best academic success that they can. Those fall under the header of the Education for Homeless Children and Youth program. And typically, the state receives less than $1 million a year each year from the federal Department of Education to support districts in doing that service. The service is obviously much more extensive than that, and that only reaches a portion of the school district statewide. But it is a really important resource that is assisting students. The American Rescue Plan did have a one-time bump as well for that program. The state's Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program is another really critical resource. These are services that are really designed to help keep families that are facing a housing crisis in housing that they already have, or quickly return them to housing. So tends to really prioritize very fast, light touch interventions that are about keeping families as stable in housing as possible. We're also very excited about the local homeless prevention aid that was passed as part of last year's legislative session that will give counties directly resources that they can use to address these issues. Those first dollars start to flow in December of this year. And if you're interested in a deeper dive at the range of other targeted homeless programs, some of which also serve families and children, there's a link on the page to a pretty extensive summary of those programs that we did as part of the Preventing Homelessness Division in a hearing last year. And finally, worth also noting that the availability of other forms of economic assistance and healthcare and human service programs also obviously play a really important supportive role for families and children experiencing homelessness. Rarely have the tools to specifically address housing crises that may occur are really important supports for those families. So turning the corner now, I really just want to help describe why we think Homework Starts with Home is such an important intervention then to not only scale up to reach more of the children that it's eligible to serve today, but importantly also to expand that eligibility to include early childhood. The critical kind of idea behind Homework Starts with Home is really that instead of the current situation of families having to navigate what are often very complicated and disconnected supports that might help address the educational needs of their kids, their housing stability, whatever other issues may be coming up, the real core of Homework Starts with Home is the idea of actually having local communities organize those responses together and design a network that is really much more family-centric and that is formalized. There's actually an MOU that exists among partners working on a Homework Starts with Home program so that they can really interoperate in a way that typically doesn't happen today. And then, of course, the other critical ingredient in that is that that partnership is also resourced. So there are rel subsidies that help make housing affordable for families when they're connected to a Homework Starts with Home program. There's flexible funds that can pay for things like supportive services and really getting the families connected to the right resource to resolve their housing crisis and to remain stably housed. The other thing to note in those partnerships is that these are not one size fits all. Really every Homework Starts with Home grantee ends up identifying the right local partners, the right way to operate, the right division of labor among those partners, and that ability to really customize this response to what the local opportunities and needs are, we think has been a real strength of the program. This next picture is a somewhat complicated and dense summary of where the funding for these interventions has been really since the pilot project that preceded Homework Starts with Home began all the way back in 2014. And I think what I'll share is that there has been a series of one-time appropriations initially to that pilot and then to Homework Starts with Home. Homework Starts with Home also really attracted a lot of important support from philanthropy. And so the initial round of Homework Starts with Home actually had philanthropic dollars bundled with state agency resources to be able to support those initial grantees. We've also tried interventions like the Homework Starts with Home planning grants to let communities really figure out together in partnership what would be the best way to organize their resources to better support families in their community, and have found that those have been a really effective way for communities to shape not only an effective partnership, but also a really competitive application for future Homework Starts with Home resources. We are currently sitting at $3.5 million per year base funding, and that's letting us reach through the three most recently announced grantees, we estimate about 324 families and about double that many children. And the next thing I want to just mention is that in addition to really seeing this as an important opportunity to advance the resources that are available for families, we've also really viewed adding to our understanding of this issue as a critical outcome for the state. And so all the way back with that pilot project, conducted an interagency evaluation of its impact that I'll share with you in just a moment. And since 2017, I've had an absolutely remarkable partnership with the University of Minnesota, led by Dr. Ann Mastin, that Dr. Herbers mentioned earlier, that is really working in partnership with the state agencies supporting Homework Starts with Home and the grantees receiving those funds and our various data systems to really illuminate what is working and what the strongest evidence is of the most effective responses. And so I would love to spend an hour talking about those evaluation results, but can't.
Mr. Grumdahl, I will say we'd like to move to questions by 11:30. So, and we do want to get Mr. Kitzberger in yet. So,
and thankfully this is the last slide that I have left, okay. Madam Chair. So, so what I'll just share with you very briefly is that really throughout the life of this program, we've seen just really remarkable evidence of the impact, starting with that pilot program where 90% of families were stably housed And we saw really important early indications of educational impact for kids. And that continues with this much more robust partnership with the University of Minnesota, where we've not only confirmed that that our homework starts with home grantees are reaching the kids who most need these resources, but also the impact of those resources is stabilizing housing and attendance and school mobility. And we're seeing a decrease in the use of crisis services on the part of those families, really correlated with that access to stable housing. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to turn this over to Mr.
Kitzberger. We'll turn it to Mr. Kitzberger from Minnesota Housing. Welcome. Do you want to clear the screen, or is he going to use the same screen?
I think we'll just use the same slides, Madam Chair. So I just wanted to briefly highlight the governor's recommendation for Homework Starts with Home as part of his budget supplemental budget recommendations. Governor's recommending to invest an additional $10 million per year on top of the existing base of $1.75 million per year. I think that maybe reads as though it should total $10 million, but the governor is recommending to add it to the existing base. And then, of course, as discussed, to expand eligibility to include household or families who are expecting or have children in early childhood age ranges. And so that's any age range through grade 12 would be eligible. And we think this would reach an additional 1,425 families each year. And this is just one piece, if you wanted to go ahead to the next slide, Eric, of a larger housing and homelessness proposal that the governor has put together across numerous agencies, over $1 billion in proposed investments over the next 3 years. This is everything from prevention resources to shelter capital, all the way to rental assistance and affordable home ownership development and down payment and closing cost assistance program. So a very comprehensive approach. And I know Madam Chair will be presenting the budget in its entirety for the housing for Minnesota Housing in your committee in the coming weeks. And we look forward to discussing the entirety of the budget recommendations with members of both the House and Senate here in the next few months. So with that, we can get into questions and discussion.
And this slide does show the complexity of it, does it, across the, and now I believe I'm handing the gavel over to Representative Gomez to deal with the Q&A portion of the meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to all of our presenters. We'll take member questions. I saw that Representative Damuth had her, there it is. Representative Damuth, please go ahead. Good to see you.
To see you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's an honor to be a part of the group that is here and what we've heard presented and the joining together of our forces of our committees. My question is a fairly simple one, and it would be directed to Director Grumdahl. What I'm seeing is on slide 12, the local homeless prevention aid, as you mentioned, is going to be forthcoming. What is the dollar amount for that? And then the dollars, as I'm understanding, are to be starting in December. And just wondering why we're not starting till December, knowing that we have such a great need now.
Mr. Grumdahl.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think the quickest answer to that question is that the funding is really a unique funding vehicle in the context of homeless services. It's a local government aid. And so it flows on a schedule that's really defined as the way that those government aids are issued. And so they're issued in two portions to the jurisdictions that are eligible to receive them. One is in December, the other in June, and that just kind of operates on a schedule. They're a formula-based allocation of funding. So very, very different in many respects from the other funding sources that go to support homeless programs, but we are excited to see kind of the impact that those will have. That is a $20 million per year program. And again, the first dollars flow in December of 2022.
Thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. Representative Damuth?
That answers my question. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. And happy to chat more about that program offline if you'd like. Any other member questions? Vice Chair Howard, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank all those that presented and just make the point that when you look at all the intersections and downstream impacts when children don't have access to stable housing, I really can't think of a more efficient or an impactful use of public dollars than this Homework Starts with Home program. And to target those resources for families or for children to birth seems to make so much sense. And this really feels like a good investment. My one question for us, and I don't know if I have an answer, and I just put this to our members as we go about our budget process. You know, it's always been interesting to me that Homework Starts with Home feels like a program that could live in a couple different places in our state budget, whether it be the Minnesota housing budget or when we talk about education or early childhood. And I just raise this as an issue that, you know, we're so severely underinvesting in housing. It represents 0.3% of our state budget. And when you look at the need of this Homework Starts with Home program, I think you can make a case that could potentially, where it lives could impact the type of resource we could put into it. And so I just put that out there as a question for us to consider going forward with such a meaningful and an important program that warrants our investment.
Thank you, Vice Chair Howard. Next up is Representative Cagle. And just so for members to note, we're gonna try to finish up by 11:50 so that we can pass Representative Pinto's bill out of committee. So keep that in mind as we're asking questions.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And not so much of a question, but just kind of, you know, what I've heard today is that providing housing is just not only the right thing to do for fellow human beings, but, you know, really, you know, we all serve on other committees. And so this will really help to alleviate stress on our healthcare system, on our school system, on our justice system, on our public safety system. So providing homes for people is alleviating stressors on all that other on all those other systems and really allowing people to thrive. And so I really, really hope that we start to think about these policies in a holistic view. I think it's, you know, it's kind of funny that we serve on committees, but all of this stuff intertwines so much. And so I just really think, I hope that we have that kind of, you know, that we're thinking about that when we're sitting in our other committees as well. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I'm thinking about the way that like negative outcomes can cascade for people, but also that positive ones can when we make smart investments. So thank you for lifting that up. I appreciate it. Chair Davney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Dr. Herber's referenced Dr. Mastin from the Institute for Child Development, it reminded me of a few years ago, Professor Mastin was before the Education Finance Committee. And as she was getting up to leave after providing her testimony, she sat back down briefly and said, "You won't close the achievement gaps in education until you end childhood homelessness." Clear, succinct, and to the point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is such a impactful group of testifiers to listen to. It's such an impactful bill that Chair Pinto has brought before us to expand this program. And I really wanted to lift up, and that I had the opportunity to speak after Chair Davney just mentioned that, is that I really want us to keep in mind that it can feel sometimes like people aren't dealing with this in your community, but we know that people and families and children are living with housing instability all across the state of Minnesota. It's happening in the metro, it's happening in the suburbs, it's happening in greater Minnesota. And I was struck by one of the comments about wraparound services and how important it is to meet families where they are. as a side note, and I know another piece of the governor's budget is the Reach Out and Read program, and that I've carried funding proposals for previously. And it's really the part of the benefit of that program is that we know that, you know, sometimes even if families are experiencing homelessness, they still are able to get to medical appointments. And so then the doctor meets them where they are. We're not, you know, it's a service where we're not having to find them in another place or them have to go to another place. And so I think that one of the biggest benefits of this is that we reach the families where they are. And I think that, we know that they're everywhere. So improving and expanding this piece of legislation, I think is critical. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanna thank all the chairs for arranging this really impactful meeting. Some of us, know this because we see it in our communities and it's a everyday reality for our communities. And we understand that if we can get it, you know, right for our young ones, then we get it right for Minnesota. We would get it right morally and economically. Every child deserves to start off a good life. And that good life starts with a stable place to call home. Everything else falls in. If families are not worried about where they're gonna sleep tonight, then everything else becomes a secondary. So I'm really excited to see all of these dots connected. I hope that all of us will do everything absolutely possible to continue to advocate for this, because poverty is a crime. Our kids should not be experiencing homelessness. Our kids should not be worried about food to eat. Our kids should be just kids and should just live life and worry about being kids. That's it. That's the only thing they should worry about. And every angle of life is interconnected. The recent violence that we're seeing is connected to, you know, young people not having something to do, you know, all the, you know, activity places and gyms being closed. So I hope that all of us will just like take this to heart and look into every possible way to uplift this, because this is really important. If we can get it for our young ones, get it right for our young ones, we get it right for Minnesota. And I'm really thankful for the chairs for bringing us together and connecting the dots. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Hassan. Are there any other member questions or comments before we go to the vote?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, please go ahead, Chair.
Just to sort of wrap up this portion of it, something that jumped out to me, members, from Dr. Herber's presentation was the extent to which child well-being, especially when a kid is really little, is tied up with the well-being of the caregiver. I felt like so many of the items in that chart she showed. So all the comments we're making about housing and homelessness, to my mind, that's really important. And we want to be thinking about that, but the mechanism of that, at least what I got from Dr. Herber's presentation, is as much because of the impact of housing instability on the caregiver, which then reflects on the child, which when you think about food insecurity, you think about all the other aspects. So really what we're trying to do is lift up caregivers, because that'll lift up their young kids. And of course, one critical aspect of lifting up a caregiver is how hard housing instability is on adults. And so then it can be the impact on our young kids. So I really appreciate this conversation. And I especially want to thank the administration. I hadn't done this earlier, Commissioner Bailey and of course, Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, and what they've put forward in this Homework Starts at Home proposal. And I want to highlight, I had referenced starting at birth, and I think Representative Howard made that comment as well. And to note that the proposal actually starts prenatally, which is critical. That's the most important time to invest. And the most important time of growth, in fact, is prenatally. And so really appreciate the push on that. And then as long as I have the floor with this, I also just want to thank not only the two chairs, but also Owen Wirth, Sydney Spreck, and Sean Herring, the committee administrators who helped to pull this together, and really grateful. And then, yeah, with that, Madam Chair, I think that we can move to the early childhood specific portion of this and bring on Vice Chair Pryor, and I'll have a motion for those committee members.
Great. Passing the fake gavel over to Vice Chair Pryor. Welcome.
You know what? I've got a gavel. I should be going grabbing that. So and figuratively handing it around too. So thank you. As a member of one of these committees, I do want to thank our chairs also for the work that you did to bring us all together and how each of us are benefiting from it as and we can do better work in our own individual committees after this. But we do have an important bill to pass. And so, Chair Pinto, would you like to move House File 3210 to be referred from the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy?
I do make that motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And would you like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in your preferred form?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, I mentioned this at the very beginning. This simply will make sure that when a family has a child who's turned 18 but is still in school, that they can continue to be eligible for this program. That's the A1 amendment. I do move that, Madam Chair.
All right. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Pinto, any final comments on your bill as amended?
My only comment is just to remind folks that this is just the Early Childhood Committee voting. So my apologies to the others, but it's a small committee that shouldn't take too long. So and with that, I just appreciate folks' support.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Chair Pinto renews his motion to refer House File 3210 as amended to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy. The clerk will take the role of the Early Childhood Committee members.
Aye. Chair Pinto, aye. Vice Chair Pryor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Pryor, aye. Lead Franzen. Lead Franzen. Representative Bennett is excused. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Daniels is excused. Representative Davney.
Davney votes aye.
Davney aye. Representative Damuth. Representative Damuth. Representative Juergens. Representative Juergens. Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Cotiza-Watoon votes aye.
Cotiza-Watoon aye. Representative Morrison is excused. Representative Wazlewick.
Wazlewick aye.
Wazlewick aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott aye. Resulting in 6 ayes. 0 nays.
With a vote of 6 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3210, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy. I will turn the gavel over to Chair Pinto.
And just to see if, and my thanks again to Chairs Hausman and Gomez. I don't know if either of them has anything they want to say before we adjourn, but I've just been really grateful for the partnership here. I'm seeing nodding and not unmuting. So with that, this joint hearing is adjourned. Many thanks to everyone, especially Dr. Herbers. Thank you.